KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's going to be cloudy tonight, the low in the upper 30s, cloudy tomorrow with a chance of rain, the high in the low 50s.
I'm going to get up every single morning the next 4 years doing everything I possibly can to help improve the economy and people's lot in life in this state.
Well, the story of finding bin Laden is a lot more than that 40-minute raid that took place in May of 2011.
There were black people who were saying, well, why are you doing the white man's art form, not wanting us to be participating in this? And there were white people saying, you don't have the bodies, you don't have the temperament.
Virginia Johnson talking about being a black dancer. We're going to hear more from the woman who has taken over the Dance Theater of Harlem from our Art of the City segment with Marcy Silman. Mark Bowden's going to talk about bin Laden and the hunt for bin Laden. We're also going to hear from Carlos Gil about how we became Mexican-Americans. But we start with Governor-elect Jay Inslee, who joins us by phone to talk about his work. Governor-elect Jay Inslee, congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm glad you're talking to us today, and thanks for taking the time.
You bet.
Three change agents, President Elson Floyd, a Renton School superintendent, and Vice President Brad Smith. What are they bringing to Olympia?
Well, this is our transition co-chairs of our transition team, and I'm very pleased that we've got these talents to pitch in on this. And the reason is I think they represent, you know, maybe three legs of the stool of our economic growth in our state. We've got Brad Smith at Microsoft, who is still leading a very innovative culture at Microsoft, and I hope is going to be successful in attracting some private enterprise talent to state government. Folks who have been successful in bringing efficiency systems, folks who have been successful in attracting innovative talent themselves, and I'm very excited about Brad's join us. We have Mary Alice Huschel, who's the superintendent of Renton Schools, and she has been so successful in bringing innovation into the public schools in Renton. They have increased their graduation rate, I think, probably about 28%. It's now at 90%. These are a lot of children who, you know, have kids from a lot of challenging backgrounds. And because she has been able to raise the bar on expectations, and because she has been able to embed new innovative ways of curriculum and reaching kids, she's had great success, and we need that in our K-12 system. We've got Elson Floyd, Dr. Floyd at WSU, who has really been a great leader in expanding access to college education. And we know we have such challenges on that, both because of tuition and other reasons. And it was really interesting going around the state during the campaign. I would see Elson's work, you know, in Vancouver, where we have such a tremendous campus that's working really well with the business community to adopt new technologies in Vancouver, where we have a new life sciences building, our campus in Spokane, which really is the potential birth of a biotech and life sciences industry in Spokane. And that's why I think his leadership will really help us uniting our state and make sure that we grow the economy across the state and access. So I'm very pleased about the team. It's a good start. We got a lot of work to do.
Who is your Olympia insider who's going to help you with the transition into understanding that culture?
Well, you know, we're going to have people both of inside and outside. We're going to bring a lot of new blood into the team. But we'll have people who have worked there. We're not going to have, you know, there will be people who will remain in the administration. It has been in the existing one. But we're going to have a lot of new folks as well, particularly from those from private enterprise as well. On my campaign team, we have people with experience. And I've been there. I served as a legislator from Yakima County from 88 to 92. So I think you point out something that it's important to have balance. We'll have a well-balanced. But we do have to recognize with our challenges, we've got to find new ways of doing business in state government. And I am going to bring people in who will help me make sure that we embed the principles of lean management in state government that have been so successful at Boeing and Children's and Virginia Mason and Genie Industries and other places across the state. We have to do this. I am very confident of our ability to produce more public services using these systems of quality improvement. And we've started that process, but we've got a long ways to go in state government.
Now, I know you don't want to be another governor who says we're not raising taxes except for an emergency, which was what other governors have said, and then, boom, here's an emergency. So I imagine you're going to tell me you're sticking by your pledge. You don't need new revenues initially, but you face a projected $900 million deficit for the budget 2013-2015. And you have heard the people say the math isn't adding up. So you must be scratching your head and saying, I got to make this math add up. Where are you looking?
Well, we are going to make the math add up, and obviously we're going to succeed on that. We're going to have a balanced budget. I know we're going to succeed on that. I do believe there are four things we need to do, and the largest one is job creation. And as we've talked about before, we have to look at the principal reason we are in a fiscal hole right now. I mean, when I studied economics at the U, you always need to go to the principal reason for the dynamic situation you're in, and that is we have 300,000 people out of work in the state of Washington. And as a result of that, we've had a reduction of what we otherwise would have had in the state treasury of $4.2 billion, a 19% reduction. So we really do have to focus on job creation. Ultimately, has to be the economic engine to drive fiscal solution to our state problems. Now, the second thing I'm going to tackle very early in my administration is to be very aggressive on health care costs, because we have health care inflation that is, in some of our cohorts, twice the rate of economic growth in our state, and we cannot accept that. You cannot have health care inflation that's growing twice as fast as your economy. So we're going to be very assertive in finding new ways of developing preventive-based health care systems that I believe have the potential to have significant savings. Third, we're going to embed these lean management principles that I believe can get more bang for the buck. And fourth, there will be, and I'm going to ask the legislators to really stand up and be counted on some of these corporate loopholes that really need to be reviewed, that, you know, may have been created 40 years ago when it was appropriate, but the economy has changed, that are no longer necessary. And I'm going to urge them to have a regular review of those, so that corporate loopholes that are no longer creating jobs can help plug this gap in educational funding.
Healthcare, corporate loopholes, lean management, all things that you think will affect this upcoming biennium budget?
Yes, obviously things don't happen in 24 hours, but I think even in this biennium, there's things we can do on healthcare in that regard. There are certainly things we can do on some of the loophole front, and I'm hopeful on job creation as well. And I do think there's some signs that we may have a little more optimism than, or we may deserve a little more optimism than we have. You know, it's interesting. I just was talking to a leader of the largest architectural firm in the world this morning, on the boat this morning, and she was telling me that Seattle is one of the three hottest targets for development of building structure right now in the world. So there may be some reason to be a little more optimistic about some of these forecasts, but one way or another, we're going to have a balanced budget.
Have you talked with the feds about the impact of the marijuana initiative on the state?
I have not, but I am very hopeful that we are going to succeed in convincing the administration to allow the will of the voters in Washington to be respected. I believe this is a local decision. It should be made by local voters. I was not supportive of the initiative, but I am going to be assertive in arguing with the administration that it ought to respect our federalism of our state, of our country. You know, we've had a successful tradition of federalism where we have allowed states to move forward with new policies, and I think it is the right decision to now allow Washington and Colorado to move forward with this policy, and I will be arguing with that with the administration. There is no national security reason the federal government would have to intrude on our own decision-making. There's no environmental reason. This is a local decision with local impacts. So I will be arguing that, and I hope we'll succeed on that.
The money will help.
Initiative. Yeah, I don't think it's the primary reason for doing this. The reason for doing this is that the voters have spoken, and we've made a decision, a democratic decision on our local community, and it ought to be respected in Washington, D.C., and I will be arguing that.
Last quick question. What impact will the success of the Charter Schools Amendment have on your ability to fund public schools amply, as the Constitution is mandating?
Well, as you know, I was concerned of that and do remain concerned where the schools are developed. It will, unfortunately, siphon dollars out of existing schools, and we'll just have to try to figure out how to deal with that. Again, voters have voted on this. We'll try to make it successful. We're going to try to make sure that that these schools are open to all students, and in fact, we don't end up with some of the negative consequences that have happened other places. And I'm going to work with everyone who was an advocate of this position to make them work. I think it's the right decision.
All right, Governor-elect Jay Inslee, I appreciate you taking the time. I hope we can talk again as time goes on.
You're on. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Jay Inslee is the governor-elect of Washington State. We're going to talk about how we became Mexican-American. That's coming up.
Washington voters made their mark on history last week by approving same-sex marriage and legalizing marijuana. These policies take effect on December 6th. So what is King County doing to get ready? We'll pose that question to King County Executive Dow Constantine later this morning at 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org.
We have an interesting mix of sun, fog, and clouds in Seattle. It's 43 degrees right now in the U District. Forecast says it's going to be all cloudy later today with a high reaching 47. Cloudy tonight as well, the low in the upper 30s. Cloudy again tomorrow with a chance of rain in the afternoon. Tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. Some years ago, Carlos Gil sat next to an 80-year-old man on a bus who regaled him with his knowledge of American cities. He had been part of the Bracero program. Just one example of how Mexicans have been becoming Mexican-Americans for decades, even centuries. Mm-hmm. Professor Hill tells his own coming-of-country story in a new book that explores the passage from immigrant to citizen. We became Mexican-American, how our immigrant family survived to pursue the American dream. Thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you for inviting me, Steve.
Professor Carlos Hill is an emeritus professor of Latin American, Latino, Mexican-American history in the Department of History at the UW. You know, I've been saying through this introduction before, too, how we became Mexican-American. Because in a way, I think that once we start hyphenating, we all become part of that hyphen in a sense, because Mexican-Americans are affecting the entire culture. And we see that in the election. We saw that in the election, right? We are all sharing in the impact of immigrants.
Definitely.
What did you make of the fact that, in Washington State, to be sure, mm-hmm. it looks like Latino voters helped put Jay Inslee mm-hmm. into the governorship?
Definitely, yeah. Right.
What are we learning about the impact of Latinos today in this state?
I think it's the coming of age, Steve. My book shows that we've been around for 100 years, and my own family is basically 90 years here. And so the first generation, as I show in my book, they come, they work hard, they contribute with their labor to the American economy, to the opening up of the American West, cities, roads, and so on. They settle down, and then they have us, the second generation, my generation, and we happily happen to coincide when we come of late teenage and early 20s, we coincide with the inclusive democratic administrations and their policies. And the reason that I say that is because thanks to policies started by John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, the universities began to open up to us. That wasn't the case before when I was a kid, when I was 12, 15. In fact, when I began to go to school, to college, I thought I was the only one, you know, of my color, my background.
Let me come back to that and get there by tell us a little bit about your grandmother and your mother and your uncle's trip across the border.
Well, they arrived from west central Mexico. They were peasants, farm workers, born farm workers on an hacienda, a plantation. They were expected to live as that and die on the plantation that way. So they, for a bunch of reasons, they decided to leave. They could leave. They were able to leave, which wasn't always the case. And so they arrive at the border. And one of the points that I make in my book is that the minute that they cross the border, Steve, they walk just a couple of blocks away from the border, and there was somebody there to sign them up for a job.
Because this was the era when that was happening?
It was the thirst for workers, especially railroad workers. Both my uncles were signed up right away to work on the railroad.
Now, what year is this?
This is 1917 for my tío Pascual and 1923 for my tío Miguel, my uncle Miguel.
Now,
when my mom and my grandmother crossed the border, two women, they were signed up to pick cotton. I mean, they didn't have to look for a job. Somebody came up and said, "We have a job for you. Come with us."
That was the promise of coming to America, huh?
Well, but there was also a tremendous need for workers, especially in those years, because this is why I'm saying the opening up of the American West. Cities are growing, streets are highways and all that kind of stuff.
Where did they settle?
And so they settled, finally they settled after kind of bouncing around, working in different places. They settled in Southern California, just about 20 miles north of Los Angeles. And they settled there because of the citrus industry.
Ah, because there was work there for there. Huh?
And yeah, and they settled in the city of San Fernando in 1927. And that's only 2 years away from the panic of Wall Street, 1929, the beginning of the Great Depression. The only reason that we, or I should say, one of the reasons that we were able to survive and stay in the U.S. instead of being encouraged to leave Mexico during the bad time is because my father was able to find a job picking fruit, since everyone believed, everyone quote unquote, believed that if you worked in the orchards, you would catch tuberculosis.
Slightly wealthier, slightly whiter people were saying, "Oh, we're not going." Even Mexican Americans were not going.
Mexican Americans were saying, "If you work in the orchards, you get TB." And so
he took the chance.
Many did,
yeah,
because they needed the job. And so I discussed that TB, in fact, was a major epidemic in those years, and there's literature about that regarding TB in the Mexican-American population, specifically San Fernando, my hometown. So that's part of the settling down. That's part of the surviving the Great Depression and so on.
Now, just one thing about your father. He came on his own. Sort of, he didn't feel like he was really welcome in his aunt's household and his uncle's household, or his uncle wasn't living there, but he was sort of watching over. So he was sort of pushed out in a sense.
My dad and my uncles and basically the rest of my family were pushed out, and that's one of the ideas in immigration. You have pushing factors and you have pulling factors. That's kind of a simplicity, but still it works. And so most of my family is really pushed out and enabled in their migration by the political instability of Mexico, the Great Mexican Revolution. It's a big chapter, even in world literature. It almost rivals the Russian Revolution of 1917.
How did he get to the border? How did your father get to the border?
Railroads. All railroads, and that had all been set into place in the preceding 25 to 30 years. Part of what somebody wrote recently, the first globalization affecting the United States, because it was American capital that basically opened up the Mexican infrastructure.
And he was a young boy. He sort of hooked himself up with a family that was going north that were going to fight.
Precisely, in as part of the revolutionary turmoil. And my Uncle Pascual, same thing. He became a young soldier. He's only 15, Steve. And the climate of the times just scoops him up, puts him into this brigade or this battalion, and they chase. Part of the battalion was chasing after Pancho Villa, but he wasn't assigned to do that. He was sent to hold on to some horses and what else. And that takes him up to the border, and they go to the border, and they skip town and cross over. And immediately he gets a job on the railroad.
Now, is the emphasis that he gets that opportunity, that's not always... How does that compare with today's immigrants?
Well, there's a very strong comparison. There's a strong parallel, Steve, because many, many of the men who were crossing, say, in the 50s and 60s, legally or illegally across the border, they had a job. They had a boss. They had a boss, in fact, that was waiting for them through correspondence. Nowadays, in our time, many, it's hard to know how many, already have those job connections. It's not a first time they're coming in. It's multiple times. In the case, there's a lot of them who have, it's the first time for them. But I don't know whether you've noticed, but in the recent 4 or 5 years, the number of crossovers has reduced.
Because of the economy, they say.
Because of the economy. But the big argument that I want to make in a different publication, not this one, is that our economy is like a giant magnet. And these workers all across Mexico and Central America are like little particles of metal that begin to get stirred up by the magnetic waves. And that's why we have Latino immigration. And so their children and their grandchildren are now American citizens, and they're now participating more fully in the American body politic.
I noticed that the work in progress on your emeritus homepage there at the UW is a political guide for Latinos.
Yes.
That's what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Carlos Gil is author of We Became Mexican American, How Our Immigrant Family Survived to Pursue the American Dream. I want to ask you about one thing you talk about, and you mentioned it in going to college. Your older brothers and sisters have different recollections, of course, than you do, because they're older, so different generation, of the time growing up. How did they perceive how they were treated? Where you grew up compared to how you felt you were treated?
One of the arguments that I make towards the end of the book is that Mexican-Americans undergo a regionalized experience. Had we been raised in Texas, it would have been a very different thing. Arizona, very different. Southern California, very different. So in the case of my brothers and sisters, I think their response to Anglo-America is is very much like mine. It's a benign toleration, a benign acceptance, but not understanding, not fully understanding. And the institutions are basically closed, especially for my older brothers and sisters. They don't really open up until I graduate from high school in 55, and by a fluke, I come to Seattle University. And then it's at the end of my time at Seattle University that schools begin to open up.
Well, you have this section. Why was there not a word about discrimination or racism when your mom was talking, when your brothers and sisters were talking? Yet you talk about the institutional racism that existed. But what was their attitude that kept them from you know, talking about the oppressive Anglo culture?
It's a great question, Steve. And I think the best answer that I can offer is that their vision was not oriented towards these larger issues. Their vision was oriented towards surviving, getting a job, working, bringing the money home, and dealing with the kids. So they didn't raise their views up very much. Had they belonged to some kind of active union or something, of which there were some.
And you had some relatives.
Your
uncle, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. So my tio Pascual, for example, had a higher elevated vision on that. And so I'm trying to be honest because they don't say, there's racism in America, there's racism in Southern California. They don't. So I'm trying to explain that at the very end of the book.
But by the way, you do say that compared to Texas, for example, Texas, they might have felt it more because Texas sounds like a much more oppressive place.
Oh, Texas was awful, awful, awful. I mean, the Mexicans and blacks were equally prohibited from utilizing public space, buses, restaurants, churches, movie theaters.
You said where you went where you grew up in California, you had the price for a ticket. You got into a movie theater, for example.
Yes, and so I explain in my book that in Southern California there existed something that nobody has identified as such, but I call it a multicultural, laissez-faire kind of toleration.
Well, so what do you think? I mean, California was Mexico before it was. Before it was the United States.
But it develops in a very different way in comparison to Arizona and Texas. And I think the key factor is that it industrializes very quickly. So it produces jobs that draws people away from the farm. And that's different from Texas, and that's different from Arizona.
All right, Carlos Heel, last quick question here, because this is going to be for our next conversation. What about the third generation? What are they doing?
The third generation is coming along, perhaps not as rapidly as I would like, but I interview them, and I include them in my book, because I ask them, what kind of jobs do you have? Which is the best job you've had so far? And they basically give me a list, and I offer a list of the kinds of jobs that they have. And the jobs go from all the way from a delivery guy who's delivering auto parts in different parts of Los Angeles all the way to a state judge in Washington State. So the variety is pretty wide.
When you look at the immigration experience, the immigrant experience for Jews, Italians, Irish, Asians, Latinos, is it slower, but is it on the same trajectory? And is it slower to assimilate?
Yes.
To assimilate?
Yes, I understand the question. It's very similar, and it's not so much slower that it is continually fed. In the case of the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, the Germans, they come in spurts, and there's a time period that limits those spurts. In the case of Mexicans in particular, it's a steady stream all the way because we're neighbors. And so the stream depends on the economic need of that stream. And so it looks slow, but it's really steady.
I enjoyed an article I read in the New York Times, I think it was earlier this, I guess it was Sunday, looking at the revitalization of the small towns and cities in Kansas and Nebraska because of the factories, but the slaughterhouses that were drawing people initially, and then those people are buying houses, those people are revitalizing
exactly.
The center of the country.
Exactly, and creating their own communities too on a cultural, social basis as well.
Can we talk again? Maybe when this guide comes out or before, sir, I hope. We became Mexican-American, How Our Immigrant Family Survived to Pursue the American Dream. It's Carlos B. Hill's newest book. I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Weekday.
Wouldn't it be great if all the debt that you owe, credit card and mortgage and student loans, just went poof?
If this program, for example, were actually the law of the land, I would have never gotten out of poverty because no bank in their right mind would have lent me money.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. The paradox of debt forgiveness next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
That story and much more coming up tonight at 6:30.
Support for KUOW comes from Pratt Fine Arts Center, presenting the Holiday Art Show, Saturday, November 17th through Saturday, November 24th, featuring holiday gifts by artists in hand-blown glass, sculpture, and jewelry. Information about the Holiday Art Show online at pratt.org.
It's 9:35. I'm Andy Hurst. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle University's Albers School of Business and Economics, offering graduate business degrees for working professionals. Next information session is Saturday, November 17th in Seattle. More at seattleu.edu/albers.
We have a mix of clouds and sunshine in Seattle, 43 degrees right now in the U District. Forecast says that clouds are going to take over later today with a high reaching 47. It's going to be cloudy tonight as well. The low in the upper 30s, tomorrow's high in the low 50s. We're expecting clouds all day with a chance of showers.
Now let's turn to a more recent history. One Sunday evening, more than a decade after the September 11th attacks, President Obama spoke from the White House to tell the world that the United States had carried out an operation and Osama bin Laden was dead. The work to locate bin Laden took years and ultimately led to that walled compound in Abbottabad. Mark Bowden has written about it in The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. He is national correspondent for The Atlantic, contributing editor to Vanity Fair, former reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, author of Black Hawk Down, The Best Game Ever, a couple other books in there too.
Yeah.
His latest is The Finish. Thank you for talking to us.
You're welcome, Steve.
You know, the part of this book you have said is sort of the contrast of Osama bin Laden, who decided to kill thousands of people, and Barack Obama, who decided to kill, really, one man.
Yeah.
That's pretty profound.
Well, thank you. You know, I try to ask myself when I write a story, what is this story really about at its essence? And that's, I think, what this story was really comes down to, is one person who sort of self-anointed murderer agent of God slaying people, and the other who sought a popular election and has been given the responsibility for protecting this country and feels an obligation to target someone like Osama bin Laden in order to do his job.
How does he talk? Because I know you've talked to him. How does he talk about that notion of targeting individuals, or in this case, an individual? Because he's not just targeting bin Laden, of course. He's got those drones out there targeting a set number of people,
right,
perhaps.
Well, and almost every day he's handed a dossier of someone who's come into the crosshairs of the CIA or the military. And he views it as a sort of a peculiar and relatively new job that the president is asked to do. But if you look back over, you know, Obama's speeches and writing in the last 7 or 8 years, as he assumed more and more responsibility, higher and higher office, he had to grapple in a much more realistic way with these kinds of questions. Those of us who will not have that responsibility can, you know, have abstract notions about how it ought to be done. But he actually has to think this through, and he's done so. And he's, you know, I think comfortable with that responsibility and has exercised it fairly aggressively.
But doesn't he tell you at some point that this still has to be hashed out, the amount of power he has,
right,
to launch these strikes?
He did say that. He felt it was one of his responsibilities to leave office with a process in place and precedents in place to guide, you know, future presidents in making these kinds of decisions.
What was their intention? Was their intention, because you look at it both ways. If they had captured Osama bin Laden and brought him back, there would have been X factors. But if he had been killed, there would have been Y factors. What was their intention, do you think? I know this is a little bit conjecture now.
Well, and it's not really conjecture because, I mean, unless you don't believe him, the president told me his goal was to capture him. And his hope was that he'd be able to put him on trial in federal court. And as he explained to me, he has consistently argued that the proper venue for dealing with top-level terrorists is criminal courts, and he believes that for a lot of reasons. And he's met with a very strong political opposition, most notably when he tried to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to trial in Manhattan. But he told me he felt that he would have the political capital if he captured bin Laden to make that happen, to bring him to trial in federal court.
Well, then what did the SEALs think, or what were their orders, or how did they react?
Well, the SEALs, you know, you have to understand these are guys who've been doing these raids for a decade. Some of them have been on hundreds, even thousands of raids, and they are very used to killing people. And I don't mean that to say that they relish being assassins, but these are dangerous missions. They're very often fired upon. Many of them have lost some of their best friends and comrades in these raids, and so they're not timid about using their weapons. And in this case, even though the order was to capture or kill, the first priority was for them to come home alive. And when they approached the house on the compound that night, they were fired upon. And they immediately returned fire and killed the person who was shooting at them. But I think at that point, the fate of every adult male in that household was fixed, because they were not inclined to wait to see if someone else was going to shoot at them. So they went methodically through that house and they shot and killed every adult male, the last being bin Laden.
That implies there wasn't some the leader of running that. What was his name? The man who was McTravers? What's his name?
Admiral Bill McRaven.
McRaven.
Yeah.
McTravers. McRaven. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't him saying, no matter what, right, I want bin Laden alive.
Exactly. They're not going to give that order to men who are risking their lives going into a dark house, having been fired at once. You know, your job is to either capture or kill him. And as the president told me, bin Laden would have had to have been naked and on the ground for them not to have shot him.
There was some history that came out after this book, and this is the first time I got a book with an index card in it.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
That said, as this book was coming off the press, one of the Navy SEALs who was on the raid about compound published a book in which he gave an account of the shooting of bin Laden that differs slightly from the one that appears on page 229.
Right.
And then you say that, you know, you'll correct it in later editions.
Well, not correct it so much.
Addendum.
Make changes to reflect that there is this account
yes.
that is slightly different.
And not correct because you have multiple accounts. So we have different interpretations of what happened, different opinions.
It's very minor. What we're talking about here is the sequence of shots that killed bin Laden, whether he was hit by the first SEAL who fired or whether he was not hit until the second SEAL fired, whether he was shot as he poked his head out the door or whether he was in fact shot when he was inside the bedroom. These are minor details, but really what it boils down to, and frankly where the source of conflict comes in, I think, is who actually is the person who killed Osama bin Laden. And I suspect there are going to be some slight variances in people's memories.
Well, in your book, there was an effort by the SEALs and the service to not name the individual, in right. part to honor them all.
Well, that's their culture and their code, which is they don't talk about these missions. And so when I spoke to Admiral McRaven, he told me very confidently that none of his men would ever speak about this mission. And in fact, when the president visited them afterwards, they wouldn't tell him, you know, which of their number was the one who actually killed bin Laden. But I told Admiral McRaven then I thought he was mistaken. I thought that in this case, the temptation for these men to sell their story or tell their story would be so great that they wouldn't adhere to the code. He was a little bit more idealistic about it than I'm an old newspaper man, and I've got a nose for what'll leak. And I was right. But sadly, it wasn't leaked to me. It came out after my book had gone to press. And so I think you have to take pretty seriously an account by a first-person participant. Although in my experience, that doesn't always guarantee that they're, you know, giving you the absolute truth.
Well, that was my question. I mean, what was your reaction? What's your reaction to that book? And that book is not entirely without politics. So what was your reaction to that book?
Well, you know, I understand the book. It's primarily a book about the SEAL's life and career as a SEAL and all the raids he went on. And it ends with this firsthand account of the killing of bin Laden. you know, it is what it is. I think it's valuable for those who are interested in this story because it is the only firsthand account from a SEAL who participated in it. I spoke to this guy who, when he was still in the unit, tried to convince him to talk to me, but he was too smart for me. He opted to cash in on the story himself. So I respect it, but I don't regard it as the final word on the subject.
Mark Bowden has written The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. You talk about this in the book, torture. I believe you also called it enhanced interrogation at some points.
Mm-hmm.
What did we get from that? What did we as the people who needed information get from the various people who were interrogated with enhancements?
Well, the story of how they found bin Laden is really kind of piecing together a puzzle with bits of information that came from lots of different interrogations. Some of those interrogations were, as I point out in the book, among the most notorious for their uses of torture or coercive methods. But it's also impossible to say, and it would be incorrect to say, that torture produced the critical information that led to bin Laden. Because, number one, we don't know if that same information wouldn't have come out in using different methods of interrogation. And secondly, there are instances, really prominent instances in the story, where the person being coerced, in this case Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times, actually delivered misinformation under duress. But it happened to be significant misinformation. I mean, misinformation that actually helped the CIA focus on this character, Ahmed the Kuwaiti, because they felt if he was lying about him, that he was probably pretty important.
You've said, my opinion is that all forms of coercion should be banned, practiced in only the most dramatic of circumstances, even then at the legal peril of the interrogators.
Right.
So the interrogators have to own what they're doing if they do it.
Exactly. I think that's the only way that you can control it. And the mistake that the Bush administration made was trying to authorize the use of coercive methods and you know, narrowly define when and how they should be used. And, you know, I actually wrote back in 2003 in an essay in The Atlantic, any country that attempts to authorize these sorts of practices basically unleashes the sadists.
Do you think the Obama administration has reeled those sadists back in?
Yes. In fact, the Bush administration did, you know, several years into what turned out to be, I think, a scandalous program of interrogation, which spread to virtually everyone who was arrested, as it always does. They realized that it was doing more harm to the country than good, and they stopped using those methods themselves.
Even the black sites. I mean, you know, part of the Benghazi thing now is that the CIA may have had people, you know, we hear all these rumors and nothing yeah. substantiated, but the CIA may have had a prison there, and that's why it was attacked.
It's possible. I don't know.
But we end up with this uncertainty because of the uncertainty of the very system that you're reporting on, right?
Yeah, all I know is I know that David Petraeus, you know, despite his present difficulties, has consistently, both as CENTCOM commander, commander in Iraq, commander in Afghanistan, CIA director, insisted that his men, his troops, as he put it, live their values, that they do not practice these things.
Hey, you've interviewed these guys. You've talked to these guys. Live their values. What happens?
Well, they're human beings. They don't always live up to their own standards, as we've seen. But you know what? That's common in every walk of life. I mean, you name a profession that doesn't have a, you know, middle-aged powerful men stepping out with ambitious, pretty younger women. I mean, it happened in the White House, what, not too long ago?
Yeah. What lesson do you draw from – one lesson you draw from the success of hunting down bin Laden was that the services worked together.
Right.
How are they doing today?
Well, they've gotten a lot better, and what they call this fusion of intelligence and special operations is really our primary method of war fighting right now. And it's been extremely effective in dismantling these international terrorist organizations. And while, you know, there's still a great deal of confusion about local groups in places throughout the Middle East who fly the Al-Qaeda flag, these are local groups who are a very big threat in their neighborhoods, but they are considerably different than the international terrorist organization that brought us 9/11. So, you know, I think these things can always be improved, and there will always be a degree of rivalry, you know, between agencies and individuals. But this targeting engine, which, you know, puts a dossier on the president's desk just about every other day, is one of the more remarkable developments in modern warfare.
Chilling.
It is. It's dangerous. And as the president said, you know, we need to figure out how to establish due process on these things. And, you know, they're not willing to talk about it just yet. I think they should. I think that the public should be involved in shaping these policies in a democracy. But it's also sensitive because, you know, their methods and tactics are very effective right now, and they're not eager to blow that.
The finish, the killing of Osama bin Laden, Mark Bowden. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome, Steve.
This is Weekday. Now let's hunker down with the art of our city. Marcy Silman's
now for
here.
Something completely different. Well, have you ever
heard? That is how I feel.
Yeah, right.
I would like Monty Python to march in and play. We used to play Monty Python music.
Well, this is actually a really interesting interview. Did you ever hear of the Dance Theater of Harlem?
Yes, ma'am.
Started in the late 60s by a dancer named Arthur Mitchell, who was principal dancer with George Balanchine's New York City Ballet. In fact, I believe the only African American to dance with that company in the 1950s. Wonderful dancer, and he was motivated in the 60s by the civil rights movement to go back to Harlem, where he grew up, and start a dance school, which later branched off to a professional dance company. The company was forced to close in 2004 because of budget problems, a lot like a lot of arts organizations. And 8 years later, the company's revived and opening a tour in stop in Seattle tomorrow night. And the new artistic director, Virginia Johnson, was the principal dancer under Arthur Mitchell's day, was one of the founding company members. And she came through the studio yesterday. And I asked her, first of all, to just talk about the company.
This is 1969. This is a time when there was a lot of poverty. There was a lot of segregation in the world. There was a lot of saying no to black people. His primary goal was to create opportunity for young people in Harlem to succeed in life. But then there were people like me who was, I'd studied, dance all my life. And when I was 18, I was told suddenly, it seemed to me, that there was no place for me in the art form, that, there just were no black ballerinas. So I found myself in New York, and somebody said to me that Arthur Mitchell was teaching, ballet classes in Harlem, and I went up to take class and found out that he was creating a company. And so, you know, along with the goal of creating opportunities for young people was to really dispel that myth that blacks couldn't do ballet or shouldn't do ballet.
You were then there at the beginning, at the creation.
I'm a founding member of the Dance Theater of Harlem, and that was an amazing experience, being part of this this organization from the beginning, really literally seeing minds change from our performances. People thinking that it's the 1960s. There were black people are saying, well, why are you doing the white man's art form, not wanting us to be participating in this. And there were white people saying, you don't have the bodies, you don't have the temperament. And so Arthur Mitchell was, yes, absolutely maniacal in proving them wrong. And we were the medium through which he worked.
And then the dream kind of fell apart.
Well, actually, in 2004, Dance Theater of Harlem experienced a very severe financial crisis. It's very difficult to have a performing organization. The costs are never covered by the ticket price. So we found ourselves in the situation where it was necessary to save the organization by closing down the company. You know, the organization has impacted thousands of young people through its school, through its arts and education programs. And so rather than lose everything, it was decided to shut down the company.
What happened in the meantime, in between your dancing career and where you and I sit today?
I did retire from dancing. I got too old to do this stuff anymore, which is, I had a really long and wonderful career, so I'm not complaining at all. But at some point, all good things come to an end. I'd been writing all of my life, and I decided that I would pursue journalism. And I was at Fordham University and got the opportunity to be the founding editor of Point Magazine, which was just the most amazing experience. And, you know, I think that it being at Point for those 10 years actually enabled me to step into the role of artistic director, because at Point I had to not be just focused on my performance, which I'd had to do as a performer. I had to look at the whole field of dance, and I had to look at the economics of dance. And it really gave me an education around what this world is that we had to survive in.
At what point did you rejoin something that you had, the first thing that you had helped create, a dance company?
It was 2009 when Arthur Mitchell called me up and he said, well, I'd like for you to take over as artistic director. I mean, the sound of his voice in my ear is still very vivid, because can you imagine this towering figure having faith in my ability to take the organization he created forward was something you just don't say no to. I came to DTH in 2010, and I had this group of dancers, many of whom had tremendous potential. And my goal, my task, was to revive the Dance Theatre of Harlem Company. And so I knew that I wanted to see which of these dancers who was already in the ensemble could move forward. And I challenged them with a different repertoire, and I challenged them with working differently, understanding that as a professional, the responsibility is yours. Mm. It's not mine. The teacher doesn't make you. You make you. You know, the thing that was very powerful to me was, as we went on this tour, we auditioned in San Francisco, Chicago, Miami, and New York. And we got a diverse group of dancers coming to be part of Dance Theatre of Harlem. But the number of dancers of color who were of the level that we needed was very small.
And that we referred to this earlier, this is 40 years after somebody told you no place for you, 40 years after a school had been set up at Dance Theatre of Harlem. It, still, dancers of color, for whatever reason, whether they weren't accepted into the ranks of the schools or they self-selected out, probably a little bit of both, it's a white, predominantly, or at least 2 years ago when you were touring, was predominantly a white art form.
It continues to be that. I think that we are now at the beginning of a new era. And I actually sit at my desk at Dance Theatre of Harlem, and artistic directors call me and they say, I need some dancers for my company. So there's a sea change out there, which is really wonderful. The thing is that it takes 10 years to make a dancer. So those 8 years that we didn't have Dance Theatre of Harlem as a beacon, as a role model for young people, as you say, they start. If they're not encouraged, if they don't see a place for them to go, then other things come into your perception. You decide, I'm going to do that instead.
When you sit back in your office, or maybe lay awake at night in bed, because I'm sure the money problems are still there, the economics of dance are hard, not just at Dance Theatre Harlem, but everywhere across the country. Mm. What do you dream of for this company? Where do you see it in 5 or 10 years?
Well, you know, I see a slightly bigger company, just to be practical. But I also see people not thinking about ballet as something that they don't want to see, but ballet is something that they have to go and see, something that means something to them, that they want to have in their lives and they want to share to the people that are important with them. One of the things that's happened in this country is that the arts are very marginalized. You think that you're going to do it when you have something extra. And the arts are such an important and powerful part of having a good life that in 5 years, I want people to be in that place where they go, I must have this now.
I wonder if in 10 years you're going to have lines of young African-American trained dancers knocking at your door to perform with you.
You know, that, and we're going to have lines of African-American dancers performing with companies around the world. That this whole idea that you have to have a company for them because they aren't anywhere else,
right,
is gone. It's a part of the past.
Virginia Johnson, Artistic Director, Dance Theatre of Harlem. Talk to Marcy Soman. They perform Friday, November 16th, Saturday, November 17th at the Moore Theater. We have links at KUOW.org.
And now, the sound of the day.
Don't be fooled by the train whistle. Those sounds are not train-related. The microphone is set up in the middle of the street in a small town in Myanmar between two establishments that are weaving silk on looms. Our traveling bicycle correspondent, Willie Weir, and his wife, Kat Mariner, captured that sound, saying that the rhythmic clacking made him feel like he was inside the workings of an enormous clock. We've posted a picture of the billowing silk and the looms at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. You can read about their adventures on their website, Yellow Tent Adventures. Send us some more sounds. Check it out. Stay with us.
We'll get an update from NPR News in less than 2 minutes.
Support for KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.